It was only half an hour before sailing, and Santayne's stateroom was so crowded that the stewards were forced to pass the champagne glasses over the heads of the guests, and it required only a major expedition to get from one side of the cabin to another. The only one of Santayne's friends who was not present was Blaine Malcomus. They had decided not to advertise the fact that they were sailing on the same mail ship and had agreed only to meet once they were clear of the harbour. Both A.B. Abrahams, bursting with pride, his arm hooked through David's, and Dr. Twentyman Jones, tall and lugubrious as a marabou stalk, were in the party around Santayne. They had come all the way down from Windhoek to see her off. Naturally, Sir Garry and Anna were there, as were the Ubas, General Smuts, and his little fluffy-haired wife, with her steel-rimmed spectacles making her look like an advertisement for Maserati tea. In the far corner, Chasseur was surrounded by a bevy of young ladies, and was in the middle of a story that was being followed with shrieks of amusement and gasps of incredulous wonder, when suddenly he lost track of what he had been saying and stared out of the porthole beside him. Through it, he had a view out onto the boat deck, and what had caught his attention was the glimpse of a girl's head as she passed. He couldn't see her face, just the side and back of her head, a cascade of auburn curls set on a long, slim neck, and a little ear sticking out of the curls at a jaunty angle. It was a fleeting glimpse only, but something about the angle and carriage of that head made him lose immediate interest in the females in front of him. He went up on his toes, spilling champagne, and stuck his head through the porthole. But the girl had passed by, and he only had a back view of her. She had an impossibly narrow waist, but a cheeky little rump that switched from side to side and made her skirts swing rhythmically as she walked. Her calves were perfectly turned, and her ankles slim and neat. She went round the corner with a last twitch of her bottom, leaving Chasseur determined that he must get a look at her face. "Excuse me, ladies." His audience gave little cries of disappointment, but he eased himself neatly out of their circle and began working his way towards the door. But before he reached it, the sirens started their booming thunder of warning, and the cry went up, "Last call, ladies and gentlemen, all ashore, those who are going ashore." And he knew he had run out of time. She was probably a dog, a backside like heaven and a face like hell. "And she almost certainly isn't sailing anyway," he consoled himself. Then Dr. Twentyman Jones was shaking his hand and wishing him luck for the games, and he tried to forget that bunch of auburn curls and concentrate on his social duties. But it wasn't all that easy. Out on deck he looked for an auburn head going down the gangway or in the crowd on the quay side. But Santayne was tugging at his arm as the gap between ship and land opened below them. "Come, chérie, let's go and check that dining-room seating." "But you have been invited to the captain's table, mater," he protested. "There was an invitation in the..." "Yes, but you and David haven't," she pointed out. "Come along, David. Let's go and find out where they have put the two of you, and have it changed if it's not suitable." She was up to something, Chasseur realized. Normally she would take the seating for granted, secure in the knowledge that her name was all the guarantee of preference that was necessary. But now she was insistent, and she had that look in her eye which he knew so well, and which he called her Machiavellian sparkle. "Come along, then," he agreed indulgently, and the three of them went down the walnut-panel staircase to the first-class dining-room on the deck below. At the foot of the stairs, a small group of seasoned travellers were being affable to the head waiter. 5-pound notes were disappearing like magic into that urbane gentleman's pocket, leaving no bulge, and names were being rubbed out and re-pencilled on the seating plan. Standing a little apart from the group was a tall, familiar figure that Chasseur recognised instantly. Something about him, the expectant turn of his head towards the staircase, told Chasser he was waiting for someone. And his dazzling smile as he saw Santaine made it clear who that someone was. "Good Lord, Mater!" Chasser exclaimed. "I didn't realize Blaine was sailing today. I thought he would be going later with the others." He broke off. He had felt his mother's grip on his forearm tighten, and the quick catch of her breath as she saw Blaine. "They have arranged this," he realized with a flare of amazement. That's what her excitement was. And at last it dawned upon him. You never think it of your own mother, but they are lovers. All these years, and I never saw it. The little things, insignificant at the time, but now full of meaning, came crowding back. Blaine and the Mater, damn me blind. Who would have thought it? And conflicting emotions assailed him. Of all the men in the world, I would have chosen him. In that moment he realized how much Blaine Malcolmus had come to stand in the place of the father he had never known. But the thought was followed instantly by a flush of jealous and moral indignation. Blaine Malcolmus, pillar of society and government, and Mater, who is always frowning and shaking her head at me. The naughty little devils. They have been raving away for years without anybody suspecting. Blaine was coming towards them. Santaine, this is a surprise. Mater was laughing and holding out her right hand to him. Gracious me, Blaine Malcolmus. I had no idea you were on board. Chasser thought wryly. What marvellous acting. You have had me and everybody fooled for years. The two of you make Clark Gable and Ingrid Bergman look like a pair of beginners. Then, suddenly, it didn't matter any more. The only thing that was important was that there were two girls following Blaine as he came towards Santaine. Santaine, I'm sure you remember my two daughters. This is Tara, and this is Matilda Janine. Tara. Silently, Chasser sang the name in his head. Tara, what a lovely name. It was the girl he had glimpsed on the boat deck, and she was only 100 times more stunning than he had hoped she might be. Tara. She was tall, only a few inches below his own 6 feet, but her legs were like willow wands, and her waist was like a reed. Tara. She had the face of a Madonna, a serene oval, and her complexion was a mixture of cream and flower petals, almost too perfect, yet redeemed from insipid vacuity by the smoking chestnut hair. Her father's wide, strong mouth and her own eyes, resilient as grey steel, and bright with intelligence and determination. She greeted Santaine with the correct amount of deference, and then turned to look directly at Chasser. Chasser, you too remember Tara, Blaine told him. She came out to Veltevreden 4 years ago. Was this the same noisy little pest? Chasser stared at her. The one in short skirts with scabs on her bony knees, who had embarrassed him with her boisterous and childish capers. He could not believe it was, and his voice caught in his throat. How good to see you again, Tara, after so long. Remember, Tara Malcolmus, she cautioned herself, be controlled and aloof. She almost shivered with shame as she remembered how she had gambolled and fawned around him like a puppy begging to be petted. What a callow little beast I was! But she had been smitten by a crush so powerful at first sight of him that the pain of it still lingered even now. However, she managed to display the right shade of indifference as she murmured, "Oh, have we met? I must have forgotten, forgive me." She held out her hand. "Well, it's pleasant to meet you again. Chasseur?" "Yes, Chasseur," he agreed, and he took the hand as though it were a holy talisman. "Why haven't we met again since then?" he asked himself, and immediately he saw the answer. It was deliberate. Blaine and Mater made damn sure that we never met again, in case it complicated their own little arrangement. They did not want Tara reporting back to her mama. But he was too happy to be angry with them now. "Have you made your table reservations?" he asked, without relinquishing her hand. "Daddy is sitting at the captain's table," Tara pouted lovingly at her father, "and we are to be left all alone." "The four of us could sit together," Chasseur suggested quickly. "Let's go and talk to the maître." Blaine and Santaine exchanged relieved glances. It was all going exactly as they had planned, with one twist they had not foreseen. Matilda Janine had blushed as she shook hands with David Abrahams. Of the two sisters, she was the ugly duckling, for she had inherited not only her father's wide mouth, but his large nose and prominent ears as well. And her hair was not auburn, but ginger carrot. "But he's got a big nose too," she thought defiantly, as she studied David. And then her thoughts went off on a tangent. "If Tara tells him I'm only 16, I'll just die." The voyage was a tempest of emotions, full of delights and surprises and frustrations and agonies for all of them. During the 14 days of the passage to Southampton, Blaine and Santaine saw very little of the four youngsters, meeting them for a cocktail beside the ship's pool before lunch and for a duty dance after dinner, David and Chasseur each taking a turn at whirling Santaine around the floor while Blaine did the same to his daughters. Then there would be a quick exchange of glances between the four young people, and they would make their elaborate excuses before all disappearing down into the tourist class where the real fun was, leaving Blaine and Santaine to their staid pleasures on the upper decks. Tara, in a one-piece bathing costume of lime green, was the most magnificent sight Chasseur had ever laid eyes upon. Her breasts, under the clinging material, were the shape of unripe pears, and when she came from the pool with water streaming down those long, elegant limbs, he could make out the dimple of her navel through the cloth and the hard little marbles of her nipples, and it took all his control to prevent himself groaning out loud. Matilda Janine and David discovered a mutual zany and irreverent sense of humour, and kept each other in convulsions of laughter most of the time. Matilda Janine was up at 4:30 each morning, no matter how late they'd got to bed, to give David raucous encouragement as he made his 50 circuits of the boat deck. "He moves like a panther," she told herself, "long and smooth and graceful." And she had to think up 50 new witticisms each morning to shout at him as he went bounding past her. They chased each other around the pool and wrestled ecstatically below the surface once they had managed to fall in, locked in each other's arms. But apart from a furtive pecking kiss at the door of the cadum that Matilda Janine shared with Tara, neither of them even considered carrying it any further. Although David had benefited from his brief relationship with the camel, it never occurred to him to indulge in the same acrobatics with someone as special as Matty. Chasseur, on the other hand, suffered under no such inhibitions. He was vastly more sexually experienced than David, and once he had recovered from the initial awe of Tara's beauty, he launched an insidious but determined assault on the fortress of her virginity. However, his rewards were even less spectacular than David's. It took him almost a week to work up to the stage of intimacy where Tara would allow him to spread suntan oil on her back and shoulders. In the small hours of the morning, when the lights on the dance floor were dimmed for the last dance, and the band played the sugary, romantic Poinciana, she laid her velvet soft cheek against his. But when he tried to press his lower body against hers, she allowed it for only moments before she arched her back. And when he tried to kiss her at the cabin door, she held him off with both hands on his chest and gave him that low, tantalizing laugh. "The silly little witch is totally frigid," Chessa told his reflection in the shaving mirror. "She probably has an iceberg in her knickers." Thought of those regions made him shiver with frustration, and he resolved to break off the chase. He thought of the five or six other females on board, not all of them young, who had looked at him with unmistakable invitation in their eyes. "I could have any or all of them, instead of panting along behind Miss Tinnickers." But an hour later, he was partnering her in the mixed doubles deck quoit championships, or smoothing suntan oil on that flawless, finely muscled back, with fingers that trembled with agonized desire, or trying to keep level with her in a discussion of the merits and demerits of the government's plans to disenfranchise the coloured voters of the Cape Province. He had discovered with some dismay that Tara Malcolmus had a highly developed political conscience, and that even though it was vaguely understood between him and Mater that Chassa would one day go into politics and Parliament, his grasp of and interest in the complex problems of the country was not of the same calibre as Tara's. She held views that were almost as disturbing to him as her physical attractions. "I believe, as Daddy does, that far from taking the vote away from the few black people who have it, we should be giving it to all of them." "All of them?" Chassa was appalled. "You don't really believe that, do you?" "Well, of course I do. Not all at once, but on a civilization basis. Government by those who have proved fit to govern. Give the vote to all those who have the right standards of education and responsibility. In two generations, every man and woman, black or white, could be on the roll." Chassa shuddered at the thought. His own aspirations to a seat in the House would not survive that. But this was probably the least radical of her opinions. "How can we prevent people from owning land in their own country, or from selling their labour in the best market, or prohibit them from collective bargaining?" Trade unions were the tools of Lenin and the devil. That was a fact Chassa had taken in with his mother's milk. "She's a Bolshie. But God, what a beautiful Bolshie," he thought, and pulled her to her feet to break the unpalatable lecture. "Come on, let's go for a swim." "He's an ignorant fascist," she thought furiously. But when she saw the way the other women looked at him from behind their sunglasses, she wanted to claw their eyes out of their faces. And at night, in her bunk, when she thought about the touch of his hands on her bare back and the feel of him against her on the dance floor, she blushed in the darkness at the fantasies that filled her head. "If I just let it start, just the barest beginning, I know I won't be able to stop him. I won't even want to stop him." And she steeled herself against him. "Controlled and aloof," she repeated, like a charm against the treacherous wiles of her own body. By some extraordinary coincidence, it just so happened that Blaine Malcolmus had shipped his Bentley in the hold, alongside Santaine's Daimler. "We could drive to Berlin in convoy," Santaine exclaimed, as though the idea had just occurred to her. And there was clamorous acceptance of the idea from the four younger members of the party, and immediate jockeying and lobbying for seats in the two vehicles. Santaigne and Blaine, protesting mildly, allowed themselves to be allocated the Bentley, while the others, driven by Chasseur, would follow in the Daimler. From Le Havre, they drove the dusty roads of northwestern France, through the town that still had the ring of terror in their names, Amiens and Arras. The green grass had covered the muddy battlefields where Blaine had fought, but the fields of white crosses were bright as daisies in the sunlight. "May God grant that mankind never has to live through that again," Blaine murmured, and Santaigne reached across and took his hand. In the little village of Mortomme, they parked in front of the auberge in the main street, and when Santaigne walked in through the front door to inquire for lodgings, Madame, behind the desk, recognized her instantly and screeched with excitement. "Henri, viens vite! C'est Mademoiselle de Thierry du Château!" And she rushed to embrace Santaigne and buss her on both cheeks. A travelling salesman was ousted and the best rooms put at their disposal. A little explanation was needed when Santaigne and Blaine asked for separate accommodation. But the meal they were served that night was exquisitely nostalgic for Santaigne, with all the specialities, terrines and truffles and tartes, with the wine of the region, while Madame stood beside the table and gave Santaigne all the gossip, the deaths and births, the marriages and elopements and liaisons of the last 19 years. In the early morning, Santaigne and Chasseur left the others sleeping and drove up to the chateau. It was rubble and black scorched walls, pierced with empty windows and shell holes, overgrown and desolate. And Santaigne stood in the ruins and wept for her father, who had burned with the great house, rather than abandon it to the advancing Germans. After the war, the estate had been sold off to pay the debts that the old man had accumulated over a lifetime of good living and hard drinking. It was now owned by Hennessy, the great cognac firm. The old man would have enjoyed that little irony. Santaigne smiled at the thought. Together they climbed the hillock beyond the ruined chateau, and from the crest Santaigne pointed out the orchard and plantation that marked the old wartime airfield. "That is where your father's squadron was stationed, on the edge of the orchard. I waited here every morning for the squadron to take off, and I would wave them away to battle." "They flew SE-5As, didn't they?" asked Sasha. "Only later. At first it was the old Sopwiths." She was looking up at the sky. "Your father's machine was painted bright yellow. I called him Le Petit Jaune, the little yellow one. I can see him now in his flying helmet. He used to lift the goggles so I could see his eyes as he flew past me. Oh, Chasseur, how noble and gay and young he was. A young eagle going up into the blue." They descended the hillock and drove slowly back between the vineyards. Santaigne asked Sasha to stop beside a small stone-walled barn at the corner of North Field. He watched her, puzzled, as she stood for a few minutes in the doorway of the thatched building, and then came back to the Daimler with a faint smile on her lips and a soft glow in her eyes. She saw his inquiring look and told him, "Your father and I used to meet here." In a clairvoyant insight, Chasseur realized that in this rickety old building, in a foreign land, he had been conceived. The strangeness of this knowledge remained with him as they drove back towards the auberge. At the entrance to the village in front of the little church, with its green copper spire, they topped again and went into the cemetery. Michael Courtney's grave was at the far end, beneath a yew tree. Santaigne had ordered the headstone from Africa, but had never seen it before. A marble eagle, perched on a tattered battle standard, was on the point of flight with wings spread. Shasta thought it was a little too flamboyant for a memorial to the dead. They stood side by side and read the inscription. Sacred to the memory of Captain Michael Courtney, RFC, killed in action 19th of April, 1917. Greater love hath no man. Weeds had grown up around the headstone, and they knelt together and tidied the grave. Then they stood at the foot of it, their heads bowed. Shasta had expected to be profoundly moved by his father's grave, but instead he felt remote and untouched. The man beneath the headstone had become clay long before he was born. He had felt closer to Michael Courtney 6,000 miles from here, when he had slept in his bed, worn his old thorn-proof tweed jacket, handled his Purdy shotgun and his fishing rods, or used his gold-nibbed pen and his platinum and onyx dress studs. They went back along the path to the church and found the village priest in the vestry. He was a young man, not much older than Shasta, and Santaine was disappointed, for his youth seemed to her a break in her tenuous link to Michael and the past. However, she wrote out two large checks, one for the repairs to the church's copper spire, and the other to pay for fresh flowers to be placed on Michael's grave each Sunday in perpetuity. And they went back to the Daimler with the priest's fervent benedictions following them. The following day, they all drove on to Paris. Santaine had wired ahead for accommodation at the Ritz in the Place Vendôme. Blaine and Santaine had a full round of engagements, meetings, luncheons and dinners, with various members of the French government. So the four younger members of the party were left to their own devices, and they very soon discovered that Paris was the city of romance and excitement. They rode to the first étage of the Eiffel Tower in one of the creaking elevators, and then raced each other up the open steel staircase to the very top, and oohed and aahed at the city spread below them. They strolled with arms linked along the footpath on the river bank and under the fabulous bridges of the Seine. With her baby box brownie, Tara photographed them on the steps of Montmartre with the Sacre Coeur as a backdrop. They drank coffee and ate croissants in the sidewalk cafes and lunched at the Café de la Paix, dined at La Coupole and saw La Traviata at the Opéra. At midnight, when the girls had said good night to Santaine and their father and retired demurely and dutifully to their rooms, Shasta and David smuggled them out over the balcony and they went dancing in the Boîte on the left bank or sat listening to jazz in the cellars of Montparnasse, where they discovered a black trombone player who blew a horn that made your spine curl, and a little brasserie where you could eat snails and wild strawberries at 3 in the morning. In the last dawn, as they crept down the corridor to get the girls back to their room, they heard familiar voices in the elevator cage as it came up to their floor. And only just in time, the four of them dived down the staircase and lay in a heap on the first landing, the girls stuffing handkerchiefs into their mouths to stifle their giggles, while just above them, Blaine and Santaine, resplendent in full evening dress and oblivious of their presence, left the elevator and arm in arm strolled down the passage towards Santaine's suite. They left Paris with regret and reached the German border in high spirits. They presented their passports to the French douanier and were waved through to the German side with typical Gallic panache. They left the Bentley and Daimler parked at the barrier and trooped into the German border post, where they were struck immediately by the difference in attitude between the two groups of officials. The two German officers were meticulously turned out, their leather polished to a gloss, their caps set at the exact regulation angle, and the black swastikas in a field of crimson and white on their left arms. From the wall behind their desk, a framed portrait of the Führer, stern and moustached, glowered down upon them. Blaine laid a sheaf of passports on the desktop in front of them, with a friendly, "Guten Tag, mein Herr," and stood chatting to Santaine while one of the officials went through the passports one at a time, comparing each of the holders to his or her photograph, and then stamping the visa with the Black Eagle and Swastika device, before going on to the next passport. Dave Abraham's passport was at the bottom of the pile, and when the officer came to it, he paused and reread the front cover, and then pedantically turned and perused every single page in the document, looking up at David again and scrutinizing his features after each page. After a few minutes of this, the group around David fell silent and began exchanging puzzled glances. "I think something is wrong, Blaine," Santaine said quietly, and he went to the desk. "Problem?" Blaine asked, and the official answered him in stilted but correct English. "Abrahams, it is a Jewish name, no?" Blaine flushed with irritation, but before he could reply, David stepped up to the desk beside him. "It is a Jewish name, yes," he said quietly, and the official nodded thoughtfully, tapping the passport with his forefinger. "You admit you are Jewish?" "I am Jewish," David replied in the same level tone. "It is not written in your passport that you are Jewish," the customs officer pointed out. "Should it be?" David asked. The officer shrugged and then asked, "You wish to enter Germany, and you are Jewish?" "I wish to enter Germany to take part in the Olympic Games, to which I have been invited by the German government." "Ah, you are an Olympic athlete, a Jewish Olympic athlete." "No, I am a South African Olympic athlete. Is my visa in order?" The official did not reply to the question. "Wait here, please." He went through the rear door, carrying David's passport with him. They heard him speaking to someone in the back office, and they all looked at Tara. She was the only one in the party who understood a little German. She had studied the language for her matriculation examinations and passed it on the higher grade. "What is he saying?" Blaine asked. "They are talking too fast, a lot about Jews and Olympics," Tara answered. Then the rear door opened, and the original official came back with a plump, rosy-faced man who was clearly his superior, for his uniform and his manner were grander. "Who is Abrahams?" he demanded.
"I am."
"You are a Jew? You admit you are a Jew?"
"Yes,
I am a Jew. I have said so many times. Is there something wrong with my visa?"
"You will wait, please."
This time, all three officials retired to the rear office, once more taking David's passport with them. They heard the tinkle of a telephone bell, and then the senior officer's voice, loud and obsequious.
"What's going on?" They looked to Tara.
"He's talking to somebody in Berlin," Tara told them. "He's explaining about David."
The one-sided conversation in the next room ended with "Jawohl, mein Kapitän," repeated four times, each time louder, and then a shouted "Heil Hitler!" and the tinkle of the telephone.
The three officials filed back into the front office. The rosy-faced superior stamped David's passport and handed it to him with a flourish.
"Welcome to the Third Reich," he declared,
and flung his right hand up, palm open and extended towards them, and shouted, "Heil Hitler!" Matilda Janine burst into nervous giggles.
"Isn't he a lark?"
Blaine seized her arm and marched her out of the office.